the story behind this presentation is the last 5 or so years, a group of people, most of whom are in this room, have been looking at patterns of crime in across space and time. And we've got to the point where, well, so far we've used a really simple model from epidemiology to model this, and we've got quite consistent patterns, and they're very nice, and we've said some nice things about them, and they're consistent across crime types. Most of that work has been, well, all of that work's been aspatial so far. So we're all talking about patterns around a reference burglary. And we're getting to the point now where we want to look at what do these patterns look like when you map them, so sort of bring in some sort of spatial representation. And really, this is my first attempt at doing this. What I have tried to do is use graph theory as a way of representing these patterns. And so really what I'm going to do is sort of beg from the audience, the people who know graph theory or the network people, if you could, really what I'm asking for is, I think that I've got some interesting results. What I'm interested in is elements of the work which mathematically that I haven't thought of that I could incorporate into this. And just to show that I'm sort of a nice guy, I've left in a couple of dead ends in my presentation for you to pick holes in. So, what I'm going to do is really quickly go through something called the near-repeat victimization literature. Shane spoke about the repeat victimization literature, and so I'll just summarize that really quickly. I will then present my definition of these near-repeat chains. So, how can we link up these near-repeats? So far, all of our analysis has been at the unit of pairs. We want to look at triples, quads, so on. I'm then going to define a series of descriptive statistics that we can extract from these networks of linked events and try to compare them to some sort of what we would expect on the basis of chance. And then what I'm going to finish off with is talking about how we can statistically model these near-repeat chains. Yes, that's what I'm going to do. Okay, Shane this morning spoke about repeat victimization, and it's a sort of quite an important topic in the crime prevention literature because it gives us a couple of inroads into preventing crime. Essentially, it's saying that prior victimization gives an elevated risk of future victimization, which is really useful because from a policing point of view, you don't have to protect everyone, you just focus on prior victimization. Something like 4% of all victims experience roughly 40% of crime, or at some sort of quite a significant concentration like that. And again, usefully for police, this elevated risk declines over time. So you don't have to protect people all of the time, but if you are going to act, you need to do it very quickly. What our research has done over the last 5 or so years is to look at, is to show that for around prior people who have been victimized, not only is the elevated risk extends in time, it also extends in space, so that nearby victims are at an elevated risk, just like prior victims. And that gives us some useful insights into the process, and we get into the prospective mapping, which Kate presented yesterday. And we call this elevated risk near-repeat victimization. And we see that if there's a burglary in the nearby area, there's a higher chance of being a burglary in that nearby area in space and time. Okay, so that's near-repeat victimization. And what we've used for this is the model from epidemiology, the Knox model, and essentially this is looking at pairs of events. So the unit of analysis, most of the time in criminology, is either the offender or the individual crime event. Here we're looking at pairs of events. So what we do is for n events, we generate the complete set of pairs, and that gives us n times n minus 1 divided by 2 pairs. For each pair, we calculate the spatial distance between the two events, the temporal distance between the two events, and we tabulate the number of pairs occurring at different space-time thresholds. What we would expect, if I sort of slip into epidemiology, if we're studying a disease and we're sort of trying to work out whether it's infectious or not, if we do all this, it will be infectious, or there's a contagion process or propagation, if the number of pairs occurring close in space and time is higher than we would expect on the basis of chance. So this is the sort of result that we would get. This is some results that we've gotten from some of our data. So we've got space along the bottom, time along the top. The increments of space are 100 meter units, and the time increment is 2 weeks. So lying behind this is just the frequencies that we observe in the data, and then we can color code each cell according to how different the observed data is from the expectation. So the expectation here is just that space and time are independent, and we're testing the hypothesis that there's a dependency of space and time. This is unfortunately the wrong slide. The colouring is based on p-values. What I should have shown is the ratio of the observed to expected, and it gives a similar, well here it gives a very similar picture, but here these spurious cells are all washed out because the ratio is very, very small for these ones at this distance, but quite high for these cells in the lower left corner. And basically this shows that there's a, well, we say there's sort of a, some sort of contagion process in of across space and time of burglary events. Now, so this is sort of where we're at the moment, and the only problem with this is that these patterns are essentially aspatial. We don't know where these repeats, where these near repeat pairs occur, and what we want to do is start getting into, well, where are they? Are they all in one place, or are they distributed uniformly across space? So I'm introducing a concept that I call the polyorder near repeat chain, so links of these pairs. So what we want to do is just look at the spatial distribution of these pair events, the pairs, these close pairs. And what we want to know is whether they're linked more often than we would expect on the basis of chance. If they propagate over time, so are the linkages or the chains last for a very long time, or are they short-lived? Do they snake across an area, or are they sort of form sort of like a cobweb's nest in one particular area? I should say, by the way, this is sort of a deceptively simple model. What it does do is protect us against looking at hotspots. If we had a hotspot, hotspots meant to be an area of high crime, enduring high levels of crime, we would expect a hotspot to display an excess of pairs in that direction. If we had a spate of crime, we would expect an excess of pairs here. So the fact that it's in the lower left corner sort of protects us against confusing these patterns with hotspots. The warning there. What we're interested in doing is looking at this over time. So my definition of what I call a near repeat chain is any group of events where each member is close in space and time to at least one other member of the chain. So that's people, I'm doing this for the crime people, this slide. So for the crime people, suppose I have some dummy data. I can look at how close each point is to every other point in time, and if I pick some sort of space threshold, I can say which nodes, which events are close to each other. I can do the same thing for time. So you can see that this node here is very close in space, but as the timing of these things, even though this is close in space, it might not necessarily be close in time. So to work out which nodes are close in space and time, I just look for the common links or common ties here. And so I get that sort of pattern. And these nodes aren't linked to any other. So that's my idea of a near repeat chain. I think that definition is quite good. I think it makes sense. Unfortunately, the data don't conform to really, really nice patterns. We would really like a sort of a pattern like that, you know, that's nice and linear and just snakes across areas. Or maybe a really messy one. But this is sort of a funny, you know, if we're thinking of chains of events, that doesn't really, it's not sort of intuitive maybe chain is a poor adjective, maybe clusters is a better word, but anyway, I'm just prefacing, I think this is a good definition, unfortunately in the real world it doesn't really give you excellent and nice pretty patterns.
So. Arrows, so in time I understand what direction the arrow presumably is, but in space is it also what precedes what?
Oh yeah, I mean, yeah, so I probably didn't really need to put the arrows on there, but I'm going to get into sort of directed graphs, so all of these events are ordered in time in some fashion. So, for the crime people, just ignore this, or maybe the maths people ignore this and the crime people, this is for you. Okay, so I selected, and you can tell me how wise I am, to use graph theory to look at links between events. Graph theory is about nodes and edges, and really what you're interested in looking at is the structure of these links. That's my perception. So I'm going to call the crimes nodes. So this is maths talk now. I'm going to call the crimes nodes. When two nodes are close in space and time, so they're near repeats, then there's a link between them. If I observe the temporal order of these events, I can then say that the graph is directed, and then chains, so distinct sets of these nodes that aren't linked to any other nodes, I call, well, the maths terminology is directed walks or paths or chains, whatever you're looking at. So, in terms of crime people, that's the framework that I'm using. I've used that because there is an enormous amount of theory and application of these things, and I'm hoping to leverage all of that for this purpose. Okay, so with that as an introduction, what I'm going to do is just define some of the descriptive statistics that I'm interested in my networks or graphs, and just sort of to preface, so when we get to the results, you'll understand what I'm talking about. So, the first thing I'm interested in is what physical properties of these chains or near-repeat clusters are we interested in? The first is the lifetime of these chains, so how long, what's the duration of these set of events? And the other thing is what's the area? So, are they in a tiny area or a very large area? So the duration is really easy. You just take the date of the first event and the date of the last event, and then I just take the difference, the chain area. What I've done is for all of the events in a distinct chain, I've calculated the minimum spanning ellipse. I've calculated the area of that, and then the eccentricity. The eccentricity is just a property of an ellipse which describes how distorted it is. So a circle is a special case of an ellipse, and it has an eccentricity value of zero. The eccentricity index can go up to 1, and that's a thin cigar-shaped ellipse. Okay, so that's the physical properties that I'm interested there. In terms of the network properties, so I might get something really useful out of those physical properties. I'm also interested in looking at what sort of network or graph properties can I extract out of these, out of the data, and can I make any comment about that? So the first set of things that I want to calculate is something called node degree. And this is just for a particular node, how many other nodes is it connected to? And because these are directed graphs or directed networks, we can partition that amount, the degree, into in and out degree. In degree is just how many events in the past are linked to you, and then out degree is just how many events in the future do you link to. So I calculate that for all nodes, and then the next thing that we want to look at is degree distribution. So if I can summarize all of the network according to degree, so essentially just tabulating, I've then made up a classification of nodes, and I'm using the term node motives. So these are just types of nodes, and I will show you what I mean in a second. The next property that I'm interested in is the chain order. So what's the length of the chain according to, just in terms of how many nodes are in each chain? And then the next thing is how many chains within the network, in the observed network. I'm also interested in something called triangles. So these are, Sid yesterday was talking about triads. So triangles here are just directed triads. So three events with three edges in between. So it's sort of the next step on from pairs. And lastly, I want to work out some sort of way of summarizing the motive distribution across the entire network. So here are some examples of what I'm talking about by these node motives. And essentially, these are just made these up essentially, and the rule is here in brackets, and basically they're determined by the similarity or dissimilarity of the in and out degree at the node level. So each of these labels, so there's six of these, each label is referring to the red node. So isolates are probably the most obvious. These are nodes that aren't connected to anything else. If we come across this sync node, this type of node has zero out degree but has a positive in degree. The source nodes are exactly the same the exact opposite. In degree is equal to zero and out degree is positive. Paths have the equal in degree, out degree. Amplifiers and bottlenecks is just there's a difference, and the difference is determines what direction. So amplifiers have less in degree than out degree, and bottlenecks are the exact opposite.
So in the source, you have a red connecting to the three black.
Yeah.
Then for that to be true, then I have to assume that if we label your nodes on the right-hand side as 1, 2, and 3, and we'll make red one A. A is closer to 2 than 1 is closer to 2.
So okay, just so I'm
okay,
clear.
So A,
this is close.
Now, so the red dot is closer.
A
Excellent.
To two.
To that.
No, that would be one. To two.
Yep.
Then one is closer to two.
Yep.
Okay. So the reason that it's not just a walk from A to one to two to three or what have you, or two to three to one, is because they lie outside, they lie
outside
the space thing?
At this level, I'm not really looking at the relationship between those two. I'm just looking at what are the in and out degree at the red for the red node.
Can that exist in your data?
Just that.
Huh?
Just that.
Yeah.
Possibly. Plausibly. I can't see. It might not, but I wouldn't think it's impossible.
It's impossible if one is closer than A is to two. Because then it's A to 1, 2 to 1 to 2, 2 to 3.
You're not focusing on the out degrees of the black ones. So you have presumably a list of the out degrees of the black ones.
No, that's right.
Also, this
distance
that you're seeing could represent time. So anything's possible. You haven't said that it's actual spatial separation.
But that's what I guess I'm asking.
Anything's possible. The first one, the top could happen. The top could happen in 5 minutes, separated by an hour, separated by 3 days.
It's all my thoughts.
Thank you. That's excellent. I may use that answer again. These depictions are just indicative. The rule for the sink is that the in degree just has to be positive. So the in degree could be 1, 2, 3, and so on. So don't get too sort of fixated at what these actually look like. Except for the isolates, all of these have degree differences. And so paths can be 1, 1, 2, 2, etc. So if I've got degrees of these motifs, one way to sort of, well, what I can look at is either the sum of all the sinks in, the count of all the sinks in a given network. But I might be interested in the degree of some of these sinks. So what I will do is plot the in and out degree of all the nodes, and essentially at all the coordinate points, I'm going to be able to calculate frequencies of all of these types of nodes, and I might be able to get sort of a better picture. So for example, isolates, because they're 0, 0, are going to be down here. Sinks are represented by this first row. Sinks, remember, have zero out. There's nothing going out, so located here, and they can have any sort of positive in degree. The sources, so nothing's coming in, but everything's going out, so it can sort of range up there. Paths are just where it's equal, and then obviously the other two are just either side of that diagonal. So that's what I'm going to introduce. That's how I'm going to sort of work out what the network sort of structure is. Well, that's the idea. Anyway, so data. I've got 2 years of burglary data. I've got 950 events, basically, almost. And that generates nearly 500,000 pairs. The space threshold I've got for this network is 600 meters. The time threshold is 14 days. They've been established by prior research, which showed that that combination yielded quite stable results and an excess of pairs that were significantly larger than what we would expect, roughly about twice what we would expect. And that generated, though that combination generated 2007 closed pairs. So, so of all the potential pairs, they're the only ones that there are links between. So you network people are probably thinking, wow, that's odd, because from what I've seen, most networks are a lot. They're more connected than that. That seems really small to me. Anyway, from the applications that I've read. Okay, so what am I going to do? Essentially, I'm going to create a network, and then I'm going to draw a number of descriptive statistics out of that, and then I'm going to make some comments about that and say what that means. That might not mean anything if we would expect to get those sort of results on the basis of chance. So I'm going to generate a series of expected networks based on resampling. So I'm going to generate 999 iterations, add the observed, so to give me a sample size of 1,000. So if that's confusing, so I've got space and time locations. I'm going to randomly allocate the time locations, so mix them up, and then that will help me create a new network. And I'm going to do that 999 times. The point of that is, so the basic premise is that space and time are dependent in some way. By mixing up all that time information, I'm making space and time independent. So, if that follows, then the observed, any value that I get from the observed should be different from those expected or random or generated networks. So, for maths people, all I'm doing really is constructing a series of adjacency matrices of that size, because that's the number of events I've got. Everything's equal to zero except cells I and J, where event I is close in space and time to event J, and there those cells are equal to one. From there, everything's really easy. Yes?
Now, that IJ is a directed edge, so is I preceded J?
Yes, I order all the events.
So it's not a symmetric matrix.
No, everything's in one of the diagonals. Okay, some of the descriptive statistics that I just described yield either a single value for a network or a series of values. Where I've got a single value, I just look at all the other values for the expected distribution or the generated values and just compare the observed to that. Where I've got a distribution of values, so I calculate many values from a single network, I could take the average of those or some sort of central tendency measure. But most of my values are highly skewed, so if I'm going to take that, it's just going to be a mess. So I'm just going to show the entire distribution for those. For my data, the 951 events formed 264 distinct chains. So there's a lot of separation of these clusters or chains. Not many of them are very long. They're predominantly small in size. About 100 of these chains comprise single events, and they were also relatively short-lived, so the vast bulk expired within 3 weeks.
Single events meaning two events?
No, because here I'm now talking about single crimes, and if they're linked, then that's a near repeat. So I've got 951 events,
right.
And of those events, 207, there are 207 pairings.
Right.
Yeah. Okay, so here is some data. Here are some results for the physical properties. The red line is the observed, and the black line is the expected. So order here is the number of events in each chain, and the reason you can't tell the difference between the red and the black line is because they're basically the same. The expected ends about there, and the highest value for the observed is about 61. So there is one chain that has 61 events in it, but that's atypical. Most of them are predominantly low order. This is in the top right. This is the lifetime of the chain. So how long do they last for? And the vast bulk end in about 3 weeks, and the highest is about 20 weeks, which is, that's quite long, but again, it's certainly not typical. Area measured in a square kilometre, so this is the ellipse, and as you can see, most of them are quite small in size, but there's no real difference between the expected and the observed. And this is the eccentricity, so these are ellipses that are close to zero, that form a shape that's close to zero, and these are ellipses that look like a cigar, and most of them are cigars, which kind of makes sense given that most of them are of low order, and if you think there might be some sort of directionality, so you're going to have very long, skinny, not long, but you're going to have very skinny, long ellipses.
Observed means you do the resampling and that's what you got?
So yes, correct. So that's the aggregation of all of those 999 realizations. Okay,
expected means the null hypothesis.
Correct, yes. So here we're just looking at what's the network, what are the physical properties under the null, the black line is the null hypothesis of space-time are independent, and the red line is assuming that space and time are, did I say that the right way? Independent is expected and dependent is the observed. Well, we want to see if there's much of a difference. And there doesn't seem to be much of a difference at all. What I think is operating here, because this was quite depressing, and you don't know how long that took me to do all that. What I think is going on here is this is not so much a representation of the formation of links, but this is these values are highly correlated with the space-time thresholds that I've selected. So I think that's what's going on here, but maybe someone who has looked at this more than me can identify that. So now getting into the network properties of these data. In the right column is the expected in and out degree distributions, and in the left column is the observed. And so the maximum degree in or out degree is 15, and you can see that there's quite a decay there. And also you can notice that the expected distributions are very, very similar as well. So because they were similar, I didn't really get into any of those distribution fittings. I can't remember the names of them. But if I don't say the P word, I tried to fit the P word to these. And if we ignore the zero, I got sort of quite an okay fit for anything two or more, but degree of one was a very poor fit. I don't know if having a poor fit is enough to get excited about or if that's remarkable, but it was I thought it was quite a poor fit. And the values of the power law were about 1.8 to 2.5. Didn't seem to make too much difference in any of these values, but they were uniformly poor for the degree one. Okay, so to summarize all the node motifs, remember this is how I've decided to classify nodes. There are six types, and in each of these you've got the distribute. So here this is the frequency of those node classifications that were observed at the network level. The black line is the distribution of the expected, including the observed, and the red line is just the observed value, the observed frequency. So isolates, the ones that aren't connected at all, nothing very interesting happening there. Amplifiers and bottlenecks, there are more in the observed data than we would expect on the basis of chance. Paths and sources, so paths are where the degree, where the in and out degree are equal. There's that's statistically reliably low, so we have less of those paths than we would expect on the basis of chance. And sources, there are fewer sources than we would expect on the basis of chance. Sinks, there's a lower amount, but it's not reliably lower than the expectation. So, that's interesting in itself, but remember that all of these, apart from the isolates, all of these nodes can vary according to degree. And these are just summary measures, and what I'm interested in looking at is where these bottlenecks, paths, and source differences might exist. So I'm interested in, are the sources uniformly lower than expectation, or is it constrained to just one area of that matrix? And I'm interested actually in all of them, but essentially if I can look at the frequencies of each in and out degree coordinate, I'll be able to say whether the bottlenecks are uniformly larger or constrained to just this area or this area, etc. Now, I ran into some computational problems. Once you get, if you remember, the maximum in and out degree was 15 for the observed data. Once you get up to about 10, degree 10, everything becomes very, very small and you've got lots of zeros. So I can explain this at length if you're interested, but basically I've controlled for that by making everything one. By making the expectation one, I get lots of zeros in the observed as well. And so what am I going to do? I've got the frequency for the observed networks, and then I've taken the average of the frequencies across all the generated realizations. So what I'm going to plot now is the ratio of the observed to expected. I tried looking at difference and the scale difference, but the patterns didn't really reveal anything more than the ratio did. So the point about having very low expected values here, really this isn't very interesting. We've got such low frequencies, you can't tell whether you've got spurious results. And the last thing is, here the information is quite choppy, it's very volatile, so what I've done is applied a smoothing function across all of those. The smoothing function has a bandwidth of its immediate neighbours, so I've tried to minimise the influence of the entire surface at each focal point. So what this does is we can't get too excited about the ratio levels. We can't get too fixated on them because some of them have been suppressed because of the smoothing function. And also, possibly the locations may be slightly out because of the smoothing. But it's really just to try to give an indication of what's going on. So here there are two plots showing exactly the same thing. So there's a 3D surface here on the left, and the colour coding is exactly the same for both plots. And this is just looking down on that surface. So there are a number of critical points in this surface. There's a minima here, which is sort of just the isolates actually come up, and there's nothing interesting about the isolates, if you remember from the slide down but two. There seems to be a minima here. There's two maxima, which are located there, and then there's a saddle point running along the it is running along the diagonal. Because it's a 3D plot, you can't see on the other side of that surface. So if you have a look at this here, there's nothing interesting, essentially because the numbers are so low, I've had to control for the fluctuations. The maxima are here and here, and that they essentially, if you remember, that the bottleneck is this section of this scatter plot, and there was more bottlenecks than we would expect on the basis of chance. That's clearly not uniformly distributed. It's constrained to one area. The amplifiers had a similar result. We saw more amplifiers than we would expect on the basis of chance, and they seem to be restricted to that particular location. There was fewer paths than we would expect on the basis of chance, and that seems to be just restricted to here, and that's that saddle point that I was talking about before. I think here, and somewhat here as well, this is sort of a bit of overspill from the smoothing function, because for the this row here is the sinks. This is showing that there's more than we would expect on the basis of chance, and yet the sinks weren't significantly different. And in any case, the results here are in the opposite direction. So I think that's an artifact of the smoothing function. Here, there's less of an impact. But I think what sort of trying to interpret this is what I think I need to do is for the sinks. Well, I don't need to worry about the sinks. The sources I should analyze just independent of that smoothing function. But for the amplifiers and the bottlenecks, I need to use that smoothing function.
In your picture, it looks like it's symmetric about the middle axis.
Yes.
Which would correspond to time reversal. Is that?
Yeah, okay.
It's interesting,
so,
if it's correct.
Yeah. One of the things I don't know is whether I've just created this because with my motive definitions. And one of the things I was interested, I mean, there's no reason why that has to be a reflection of that. But the fact that it is, I mean, I don't know. I haven't sort of, I can't think through. I mean, it could just be, well, the thing that's sort of interesting is that these aren't low order bottlenecks. If they were down here and this was down here, then I would think, oh, it's just a single node, a node going to two and then going back to one. You're just getting that sort of pattern. But because it's quite removed, I think it might be a little bit more than that. So with that in mind, what we probably need to do is start mapping these things. On the left-hand side, we've got all of the events in this area of Zoetermeer, and then I've mapped all of the close pairs. And this is just a kernel density surface. And as you can see, they're very, very similar. I'm doing dual kernel density functions, statistics. They're basically exactly the same surface. So here I've done a kernel density surface conditioned on node motifs. And you can see that for some of these, there's a degree of consistency across all of them, but there are some differences. So, in thinking in sort of a practical terms, how might we use this information from prevention? If you think that when a report of burglary has come in, is it possible to categorise that burglary into any of these types? The only thing we can say about a burglary is whether it has report comes in now, the only thing we can say right now, because we don't know the future, is what the in degree is of a given node. So the only thing we'll be able to say is whether it might be an isolate if the in degree is zero. If the in degree is positive, then... If it's zero, it's either an isolate or it's a source. If it's positive, then it's going to be one of those, and we won't know what that is until some point in time. So really, we should be focusing on any crime events that have an in degree zero. We can immediately categorize them into isolates and sources. What I haven't done yet is look at whether they are statistically different. There are some areas that look very similar, but there are some areas where appears to be some sort of difference. But anyway, that's sort of an area that I need to explore a bit.
What's the ratio of isolates to sources?
I'll show you. Let me just let the computer catch up. Isolates and sources. So there's more sources than there are isolates by a little bit. So there's 150 sources. There are, looks like 110 isolates.
And isolates are all the places that have no neighbors. They're all the zeros in your matrix.
Yep.
Right? You have a lot more zeros than ones in your matrix, right?
No, isolates are only those that aren't connected to anything else.
Okay.
So in the adjacency matrix, it would be just a row of zeros for that event.
And what's the overall density of your matrix?
I can't remember what it is, but it's really small.
Which would suggest a lot of isolates.
Yes, correct.
But now you're saying there's more source than isolates?
I think so. I think that's what I said. So these two plots on the top row are showing what we already know. There is about 2007 pairs, and that's the expected distribution. So you can see there's a fair degree of difference there. It's quite reliable. This is the network density. So on the base expectation, it's the density that we would expect to observe. Density is of all the pairs that could have occurred, how many actually were realized, and that's really low. But the observed is slightly higher than that. Triangles are those directed triads, so three nodes and three edges. This is the expected distribution of triads, and the observed is significantly larger than what we would expect on the basis of chance. And this final panel D shows the percentage of those directed triads that were actually observed compared to the potential number of directed triads. And again, this is significantly larger than what we would expect on the basis of chance. So, in other words, what I'm saying is that there's some sort of network structure that may be interesting, or we might be able to make comments about that. Okay, so just to summarize, I showed some results that showed some consistency with the null hypothesis of space-time independence, but I was able to observe some differences at the node motif level. There are obviously limitations in that analysis. This is just one site, and I've only looked at one space-time threshold, or at least the results are only for one space-time threshold. I have done it for a very small 100 meters in 14 days, or 7 days I think it might have been, and the maximum in and out degree were 5, so really, really tiny, and I couldn't actually get many easily interpretable results out of that. I just want to finish with how I think this needs to develop. So far there's been a couple of studies, basically all done by Shane and Kay, looking at consistency of near-repeat node attributes, so point of entry, method of entry, time of events. And that shows quite good consistency at the pair level. What I want to do is try to model chains in the same way, and what I think I need to do is look at P-star models. Essentially, this is a statistical modeling framework for, it's usually applied to social data, but I think it might help me here essentially look at what whether node attributes need to be similar or dissimilar to increase the odds of connections or links between events. And then if that's profitable, then I think what we might need to do is have a look at hierarchical P-star models So allowing the parameters that we estimate to vary according to vary at the chain level. There may be some chains which require node attributes to be very similar. There might be some chains where the offending might be such that actually it doesn't really matter what the node attributes are. Connections, well, the space-time dynamics exist regardless of the node attributes. Okay, so I'm going to leave it there.